you had enough money to go into a new car dealership, and if you went in the showroom floor and the salesman walked up to you and you said, "I'd like to look at your new cars," and he said, "Well, just, sir, come right over here." And you went over, said, "Now, this car comes with wheels if you'd like them." And then you start thinking, where did I come? He said, "Also, it can have a steering wheel, but it doesn't come with it. If you like headlights, that's extra. It has a trunk, but most of them don't." You'd think, what in the world? I thought this was standard feature. He said, "No, we do have some that have radios." You'd think, I thought all that stuff came with cars these days. They're kind of a package deal. And, of course, you would be right. There are a lot of things that come on cars that it's not really a car unless it has it. If it doesn't have an engine, it doesn't have wheels, there are just so many things. Now, if you don't have XM Sirius radio, it's like, what's happened? We're in the boondocks. But you expect a lot of things in a car. If it doesn't have it, it's not really a car. In a sense, maybe a crude description, that's kind of like it is with Christianity. There are a number of things that accompany Christianity that correspond to true, biblical, primitive New Testament Christianity, without which you're really not a New Testament Christian. Might claim to be, but not really what it is. I'd like for you to turn with me to the 6th chapter of the book of Hebrews. Hebrews, the 6th chapter. We'll look at a couple of verses here to start. As you're turning, we'll say more about Hebrews in just a moment overall, but I'd like to call your attention to really the beginning of a thought. I mean, it's in the middle of a thought, but it's the beginning of a paragraph. In verse 9, the apostle said, "But beloved, we are persuaded better things of you and things that accompany salvation, though we thus speak." Things that accompany salvation. We're persuaded that you ought to know better. You ought to be doing better. And we're persuaded that there are things that accompany salvation. And we're speaking about these that you ought to know. "For God is not unrighteous to forget your work and love which you showed toward his name, and that you ministered to the saints and still do minister." God knows what you're doing right now. "And we desire that each one of you may show the same diligence unto the fullness of hope, even to the end, that you be not sluggish, but imitators of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises." I want you to think with me backwards just a little bit. At the time when the gospel was first begun to be preached in the city of Jerusalem, most everyone in this audience I know has studied the book of Acts. The gospel was predicted, prophesied, Isaiah 2 and other places, that it would go forth here in Jerusalem. And it did. In the first several chapters, first 7 chapters, we have the spread of the gospel in Jerusalem. And then when Stephen is stoned, there arose, chapter 8, verse 1, a great persecution against the church which was in Jerusalem. And the disciples were scattered. And so in chapters 8 through 12, Luke records how the gospel spread. Well, the saints are still in some, many of them are still in Jerusalem, at least the apostles are, but they were scattered. And then as the gospel permeates and radiates from Jerusalem, we have Paul's labors, and he did a lot of work in southern Galatia, the first journey. He was over in Corinth on the second journey for about a year and a half, in Ephesus for about 3 years on the third journey. And then eventually he went to the city of Rome. He was arrested and in Jerusalem in chapter 21 of Acts. And as the events begin to unroll, you all will remember how, he was accosted by the Jews and would have been just thrown apart, torn apart. And finally, Claudius Lysias saved him. His nephew found out that there were 40 Jews who were going to kill him. And they conspired. "We're not going to eat or drink until Paul is dead." Well, when the Claudius Lysias found out about that, he sent Paul over to Caesarea under the cover of darkness, and then he went from Caesarea all the way up to Rome. And then from Rome, we have the letter writing. And he wrote, as we mentioned this morning, the Ephesian letter, and then the letters to Colossae and Philemon. He had already written the Philippian letter. I take it to be that likely, and I say likely, I know there are evidence, to me it's the preponderance of evidence, but it's not necessarily, a closed shut case, that likely Paul is the author of Hebrews, was in Rome writing to the Hebrew Christians who were there around Jerusalem. I think the 13th chapter likely sets the stage for that. He said, those of Italy salute you. They of Italy salute all them that have the rule over you, verse 24. Verse 23, he mentions Timothy. He's the only one mentioned in the letter. Timothy had been with him quite a bit. He'd been set at liberty. My thinking is, and I would just again say for the purpose of understanding that we're on the same page, that I think the evidence is more likely that Paul wrote it, and he wrote it to these Hebrew Christians. The word Hebrew is an interesting word. It goes back, most think, to Eber, who was one of the descendants of Noah. Noah, through Shem and Arphaxad, Selah, and then Eber. And it means foreigner, stranger. And the thought behind the Hebrew is that here were people who had come over from the Euphrates River Valley, and they were foreigners from them. And so by the time of the New Testament, while the word like Abraham was a Hebrew in Genesis 14:13, and it's used sometimes in a condescending and despairing way, by the time of the New Testament, in the Greek culture, the word Hebrew usually was pinpointing people who were settled around Jerusalem, who had not been carried away with the Greek culture. They spoke Hebrew, were very familiar with all of the items. They were knowledgeable of detailed Jewish practices and specifics in Jerusalem. In fact, he mentions that in verse 12. Wherefore Jesus, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, entered without the gate. Let us therefore go forth unto him without the count, bearing his reproach. They were familiar with what happened to the offerings there. And they had also been persecuted for their faith shortly after their conversion. Well, in the 10th chapter, call to remembrance the former days in which after you were enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings. This was a heavy, intense persecution after they had become Christians. Well, we see that in those early chapters of Acts, with in the third chapter, Peter and John heal the lame man. In fourth chapter, the Sadducees can't stand it that they're preaching in Jesus the resurrection, so they imprison Peter and John. All the apostles in chapter 5. Then in chapter 6, when the seven are appointed, two of whom, Stephen and Philip, by the seventh chapter, you have Stephen taken and he's killed. And so there's a progress, an intensifying of the persecution there. And likely these were Jews around Jerusalem and Palestine that are mentioned in Acts. I'll just say that's a likelihood. I believe the book was written with a twofold purpose in mind. One is to show the superiority of the new things or new things over the old. The word better is mentioned some 13 times. Better, Christ is better, superior than angels. He's been given a more excellent name than they. He was given the name of Son. We're persuaded better things of you. Melchizedek and the hope that the new covenant has is better. All these things are better. And to show the superiority, but that has an intended second effect, and that was to encourage the Jews to remain faithful and to keep from apostatizing back into Judaism. And that seems to be evident from the 13th chapter again in verse 22. I exhort you, brethren, bear with the word of exhortation, for I've written unto you in a few words. Bear with it. Don't get lost and don't go away from it. And in the 12th chapter, verse 12, Paul said, wherefore lift up the hands that hang down and the palsied knees and make straight paths for your feet, that that which is lame be not turned out of the way, but rather be healed. Those seem to be encouragements along the lines that you're about ready to go back into an area that you don't need to go. So it seems to be a twofold purpose. But I want us to concentrate for the balance of our time tonight on this idea of things that accompany salvation. Kind of like the car I mentioned. You know, would you like wheels? What about a steering wheel? Would you like a battery to go with it? No, those things come with it. We understand that. And so it is with being a Christian. There's some things that ought to be understood. And in the immediate context, I believe there are several things. In the fourth chapter, go back with me now, in the fourth chapter, beginning in verse 14, the apostle begins to talk about this, the high priesthood of Christ, how Christ has passed through the heavens. And then he begins to make a comparison between the priesthood of Christ and the Aaronic priesthood in chapter 5. And he shows the superiority of Christ over the Aaronic priesthood. And he says that Jesus Christ was named by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. That's in verse 10 of chapter 5. And that's where he begins the digression. It says if these Jews, if anybody should have known about Melchizedek and how the Messiah was a king priest like he was, it ought to be these Jews. But it was just the opposite, of whom we have many things to say, but hard of interpretation, seeing you become dull of hearing. For when by reason of the time you ought to be teachers, you have need again that someone teach you the rudiments of the first principles of the oracles of God, and have become such as have need of milk and not of solid food. For everyone that partakes of milk is without experience of the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But solid food is for full grown men, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern good and evil, between good and evil. They needed to become better hearers. I think it's possible. It doesn't matter how long we've been a Christian, whether we have just recently been converted or we were converted several years ago, that we can get in a rut where we come to services and we don't really we kind of tune in and tune out, and we don't just concentrate. There are some people I know who take better notes. I can look at their notes and it can remind me of things that are said that I never had any notes down for. My wife does that. I said, hey, what did I say on that? But to be a good hearer, you're concentrating. And that's what we have to do. We have to focus our attention, which is hard. It's hard at times. And it could very well be that we do some things that help us. Maybe we sit in a particular area of the congregation, of the building, where we're not distracted. When I was growing up, I sat with my grandparents for a good while. And like some of you do, which is a good idea. You don't get distracted. But I remember on some occasion I had to sit back. You see everything. You see everybody who sneezes, babies being passed, all those things. Somebody coughs. And it's sometimes distracting. And then you start thinking about all of that. And so a part of that which accompanies salvation is becoming a better hearer and listening to all that's being discussed. And it, in the context also, is growing past first principles. I enjoy teaching Acts, and it's almost like I continually teach it to people when I go out to the, when I go to jail, as I tell people, I go to Donaldson to teach on Wednesday mornings. But it's a constant, but it's like we can become familiar with certain passages of the Bible, and we get to be really comfortable about that. But if there's a time we need to study the divided kingdom or the minor prophets, and then somebody says, that's deep. I don't want to do that. Well, we have to get out of our comfort zone and do a little bit more. That's a part of Christianity. That's a part of something that accompanies salvation. But growing past by reason of the time, you ought to be teachers. You have need a gun that someone teach you the rudiments of the first principles of the oracles of God, and are become such as have need of milk and not of meat, not of solid food. Milk is for those without experience in the word, though for babes. Meat is for full-grown men, what we want to aim toward. So growing past first principles. I was preaching in a place one time, and we were studying the divided kingdom. And I just thought things were going great. People were putting together when the prophets had prophesied during the kings. And it was so enlightening. I just thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought a good number did. I believe I was right. Not because I was part of it. It was just a good part of the Bible story to study. And we were seeing how God could use whether it be the Syrians or the Assyrians or the Babylonians to chastise his people, depending on where we were. How he could use the various characteristics of some men and some kings to carry out his will. And so you could just see all of that, as it were, swim together in the story to develop faith in the providence of God. How God's will come to pass regardless, and he can use various nations and kings and people who don't even think that they're doing him a service. Can use him. That's just so helpful. Well, a couple of people got to one elder and said, I'm just tired of this. This is just too much. We need to go back to some. So we did. But I was disappointed. I was extremely disappointed that these were old, much older than I was, and they just didn't want to be challenged. There's a time to know Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Acts, and go back over it, yes. But you remember Jesus, when accosted by the devil, you know, if thou be the Son of God, cast these stones into bread. And Jesus said, you know, it is also written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Every word that God has given, both testaments, every word is significant. If that's not the case, could you give us a list of those words or those verses that are not significant and why? It doesn't matter what book we're in. Every word is, and so that ought to be our attitude. That when we're a Christian, that what accompanies salvation is, I want it all. I want to have a foundational knowledge, and then I want to grow there and become more mature in my understanding of God's Word. And then we grow to be teachers. We can't teach something we don't know, but we can teach something we've done. If I have believed the gospel and repented of my sins and confessed my faith, been baptized, certainly I can tell that to somebody. I can teach that. And I can go on from that. The first fellow I taught the gospel over in Atlanta, I was in school there. He was a Catholic, and I didn't know much, but I knew more than he did, and I knew what he had done was, and what he admitted he had done was not in the Bible. And the first time I ever had a part in baptizing somebody, I guess I was 19 years old, and I thought, well, you know, more people will be doing this. If I can do it, anybody can. But the truth of the matter is, we start. I think people sometimes think, well, I've got to have, you know, I've got to be at this point in my spirituality before I teach a class. You just start wherever you are and teach whoever you can what you know. And then when questions come, well, what if they ask a question I can't answer? Well, just be honest and admit it, and then study it, and then come back with an answer, you know. And there's nothing like just sheer honesty. If I don't know something, then I apologize for that, but I'll do my best to find out the answer. But we need to grow to be teachers and have experience in the word of righteousness. Everyone that partakes of milk is without experience of the word of righteousness. Righteousness, for he is a babe. That is, we have a working knowledge of it. You know, and that just takes time. When by reason of the time or a reasonable time. But to take the Word of God and be able to apply it accurately in various situations, whether it be, you know, with an individual matter, a collective matter, whether it be for me personally or somebody else, or whatever it is, take it contextually and deal with it. Have experience in the Word of righteousness. Experience is key to so much, isn't it? Sometimes we'll go to a doctor. I was talking to Brother O'Neill earlier. Is it a sign that you're getting up on in age when the first things you begin to discuss are your medical problems? his heart issues. And I was telling him about my sleep apnea. And I went to a doctor and went through this sleep test and said, well, you got a real problem. I said, I don't believe I do. Yeah, you've got a real problem. You got central sleep apnea. Well, they have expertise in these matters, experience in these matters. I may have told you, use illustration I've used in several places. most of you may remember, we had a kind of a brownish 1992 LeSabre Buick. It was such a good car for us. And it finally, like some of the other Buicks around here, it bit the dust. But we bought it when we were living in Hobart, Indiana. And I had taken it back. They had one of those free oil changes, you know. And so I'd taken it back, and a fellow told me, said, sir, would you like for me to replace your water pump? You know, you're going to need it. I said, I felt pretty keen in my sense of mechanics, you know. I thought, man. And he said, yeah, just come. And so I put my head way down in there listening to it. He says, don't you hear it? I said, sounds good to me. I just thought, yeah, they're just trying to work in some more labor on here, another couple hundred dollars. And sure enough, it wasn't 2 or 3 days later. See antifreeze dropping on the driveway there. I had a bad what? Well, the difference was, this fella is used to listening to these motors all the time, and he could detect some little nuance of sound that he knew exactly what it was, and I didn't. I didn't listen to it. I was not experienced in the noises of a GM 3800 engine, and he was. And that's the difference sometimes when we have Bible class teachers and preachers who warn us about things that are going on in the culture, in our culture around us, or proms, or music, various music, various videos, and warn about those things. Oh, what does he know? Well, if he's experienced in the word of righteousness, he may see tendencies and trends that you might not have grown to see. Just like my ear had not grown enough in detecting the nuances of sounds to be able to hear the difference in that water pump. And the same is true with spiritual matters as well. Being able to take spiritual solid food in the last part of that paragraph. That's another aspect. I have been where, you know, you preach on husbands and wives, and the lady says, oh, I'm so glad my husband heard that. That's a wonderful lesson. We just need more of those. And and then all of a sudden you preach on predestination and the foreknowledge of God. See you later. And that didn't take too well. But we need it all. And somehow, as Christians, we have to develop an appetite, shall I say, for English peas. if someone brings English peas tonight, I'll eat them, you know. But sometimes they're not my favorite. But the thing that we're trying to make is, the point we're trying to make, is that there are things in the Word of God and issues that have to be discussed that we need to know about that might not be the most exciting to learn. But that's what a part of accompanying salvation is all about. Paul mentioned in verse 10 that God is not unrighteous to forget your work and love which he showed toward his name, and that you ministered to the saints and still do. Don't ever think that when you do something that's right in the Lord's cause and good, that everybody has to know about it. I sure hope they know that I'm, and it's fine if people do. But don't think that if no one knows, maybe it's just useless to do it. God knows. And that's the point he makes here. That God is not unrighteous. There's a double negative. And you know that always stresses a positive. God is not unrighteous. That means he is very fair, very right, not to forget your work and love which you showed toward his name, in that you served, you ministered to the saints, and still do. Though you have declined in various areas, maybe intellectually, your knowledge of Melchizedek, your ability to teach, you're doing all these service, and God's happy with that. He wants you to continue to do that. And he's not unrighteous to forget all about that. But that's not all there is involved in Christianity. It's not all that accompanies salvation. That's the immediate context. From a little larger context of the book, overall, things that accompany salvation would include a number of things. And we're going to go fairly quickly. One is, One thing that accompanies salvation is understanding that God's final spokesman is Jesus Christ, the first part of the letter. Hebrews begins like no other letter. It begins kind of like a sermon, continues like a treatise, and ends like a letter. It's different. He does not identify himself, but he begins with God, having of old time spoken unto the fathers and the prophets by divers portions and in divers manners in various ways, through dreams and visions and prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the worlds, who being the effulgence of his glory, the very image of his substance, and upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had made purification of sins, sat down on the right hand of the majesty on high. The point he makes is that while God had spoken through various medium in earlier days, now he has spoken to us in his Son, who bears the very image of God. It was Christ, Jesus Christ, through whom God made the worlds. Could be the ages, it could be the whole universe. That would correspond with the 11th chapter, about verse 3. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that what is seen is not made out of things which appear. That God simply spoke, and the worlds came into existence. But in chapter 1, the point that he makes is that this person, Jesus Christ, who has a position far greater than any prophet, any angel, he is God's Son, through whom he made the worlds. He upholds all things by the word of his power. He is more important than angels, that he has spoken. So don't go back. Question in a recent Bible class came up. Why do you think he makes the point about how Christ is superior to angels in the very beginning of the letter? Well, he doesn't say exactly, but if you think about the fact that the Jews honored Moses, they honored the law. And it was the angels, Stephen said in Acts 7, that the law was given by the administration of angels. It was angels that gave the law. It was the dispensation of angels that came. Angels that were so powerful, who makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire. But of the Son, he saith, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the scepter of uprightness is the scepter of thy kingdom. Here is the eternal King of the universe. And he is the one we are to hear. And so when people say, well, I like to go back to the law, I like to go back in instrumental music and whatnot, then we have to point people to Christ and the new covenant, the final covenant under which we live. And, you know, since all of the letter is related, since Christ is greater than angels, then his word is to be more revered than that of angels in chapter 2. Therefore, we ought to give the more earnest heed to the things that were heard, lest happily we drift away from them. For if the word spoken through angels prove steadfast, every transgression, disobedience received a just recompense of reward, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? This passage tells us also another idea. People think, okay, in the Old Testament back yonder, God was this God of wrath, and when he didn't like anything done, then he let people know about it, and they were smitten off the face of the earth, or lightning came down, fire from heaven, or whatever, and they just had it right then. That's a God of wrath. But in the New Testament, it's the God of love. And whereas it was law under the Old Testament, it's grace under the New. Well, it's true. There's law under the Old Testament, and there's the finality of God's graces in the New. But while he says that if the word spoken through angels proved steadfast, that is, it was firm. And when angels through Moses spoke and people disobeyed under the Old Testament, then there was a sure punishment, a recompense of reward. It's not, but don't worry about it now. It's just the opposite. How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? If under us an inferior system with an inferior messenger or messengers, angels, people receive this, then what will it be with a superior messenger, Jesus Christ, God's Son? In the 10th chapter, he makes a similar argument when he says,
If we sin willfully, after that we have received the knowledge of the truth, there remains no more sacrifice for sins, but a certain fierceness of fire and a judgment which shall, fierceness of fire which shall devour the adversaries. A man that said it not, Moses' law, died without mercy at the mouth of two or three witnesses. Of how much severe, sore punishment shall he be judged worthy, who hath trodden underfoot the Son of God, counted the blood of the covenant an unholy thing, done despite unto the Spirit of grace. It's worse now than it was then. And that's something that is culturally, it's just the reverse. People think, well, you just don't have to worry. Just kind of, you know, idea of goodwill toward your neighbor and don't do too many bad things and it's okay, as if God's not spoken on anything. But those passages show what accompanies salvation. In the third chapter, he begins to make a contrast between Jesus Christ and Moses. How Moses was a servant and was faithful in all God's house as a servant, but Christ as a son over his house. Whose house are we? And so he warns then, he takes this great contrast between Moses and Israel in the Old Testament and Christ and the church in the New Testament. And he says in verse 12, take heed lest haply there shall be any one of you an evil heart of unbelief in falling away from the living God. But exhort one another day by day, so long as it is called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Sin is deceitful, isn't it? It has been said, I'm sure you've had it quoted before, that sin will take you farther than you're willing to go, keep you longer than you're willing to stay, make you pay more than you're willing to pay. It's the deceptive nature. Sin wouldn't, if it weren't deceptive, people wouldn't buy into it. There is a pleasure of sin, or else it would not be appealing. You remember Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. There are pleasures associated with it. And so we have to steel ourselves. Another idea on this is, say for instance, a person has obeyed the gospel and they're doing something, and then an older Christian maybe notices something and warns the younger person about something they're doing. And what's the attitude? Who are you to tell me what to do? Or is it, thanks, I appreciate you calling that to my attention. There's a warning, lest we be hardened by the practice of sin. We don't want that. So something that accompanies salvation is the fact that we need to be warned. And those of us who are older need to warn others. Let's be careful about that, my friend. Let's don't get involved in that. That's going to lead us down the wrong path, down the dark path, so to speak. We don't want to do that. So not being hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. And then the fourth chapter, he says, continuing the contrast between Israel of old and the church now, let us fear therefore, let us fear, lest haply a promise being left of entering into his rest, any one of you should seem to have come short of it. For indeed we have had the good tidings preached unto us, even as also they. But the word of hearing did not profit them, because it was mixed with faith by them that heard. Have you ever talked with people, maybe not in a setting like this, but you were maybe in a managerial position and you were warning and you could just tell by the way somebody was listening. They don't hear a word I'm saying. It's like it's in one ear and out the other, and it didn't slow down very much in between. And it can happen as we talk in settings such as this. We can warn about sexual sins. We can warn about drunkenness. We can warn about all kinds of drug use, substance abuse, as it's called. We can warn about that and then it has to make application. Somebody has to say, when he hears that,
Yeah, I'm thinking about that. When an instance comes up and I'm tempted to do this, I'm not going to. See, that's what it means to be mixed with faith by them that heard. I like to use the word assimilate. That a person hears the information and he assimilates. He puts it all together. How could that apply to me? School close by had policemen from the local unit to come in and talk to the kids about drug awareness, the DARE program. Some of you are aware of that. And once a week, talking to the kids about the warning about all the problems that come from drug abuse. And all of a sudden, you see a kid, 18, 19, 20, and he gets involved in that. And you ask him, I thought you heard all of that. I thought you heard on a weekly basis what drug... And the person says, I didn't think it applied to me. So what do you do? What do you do? Can you imagine there were those Israelites who heard Moses from his very lips warn them? I mean, you read the book of Deuteronomy and you see just one warning after another. They heard, but somehow they didn't assimilate it and say, that applies to me. Something that accompanies salvation is when we're listening to a 5-minute talk or a 35, 40-minute lesson or a Bible class. You know, it's not, let's just, when are we going to get out of here? It's just, okay, I'm going to put myself in the picture. And it's going to apply to me, and I'm going to assimilate, I'm going to mix with faith what I've heard. That's uniting faith with the word of hearing. In the 10th chapter, in verses 24 and 25, the apostle said, let us consider one another to provoke unto love and good works, or to stimulate, the New American Standard says, I believe, to love and good works, not forsaking our own assembling together, as the custom of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day drawing nigh. You know, when people are absent where I am back home, it bothers me. Well, the more people who care for the Lord, the more people who want to study the word of the Lord, and the more people who are encouraging to you, there's just that good feeling that yes, I want to, and I'm glad people are turning to the Lord. And on the other hand, people absent themselves, and you don't know what happened, and no word, no call. There's just, and you know, well, what happened? Are they sick? Do they not care? And so I need the stimulation. I need to be encouraged to love and good works just like you do. And we need it for each other. I've got a lesson that I put together about as many of the one another passages that I could find. You know, we're to speak one to another. We're to pray one to another. Speak one to another in Psalms. It's just all through the New Testament that those are mutual obligations we have with each other. And as I do it to you and you do it to me, then there's mutual growth. And that's what the apostle is talking about here. We're provoking each other to good works. And it's interesting where that verse is found. It's right before verse 25, not forsaking our own assembling together as a matter of some. Isn't it wonderful when we can come early and we can come to an assembly and Tony was at the door this morning and, you know, how you doing? Well, I'm doing fine. Well, and then you think about, well, there's Libby. She's got some problems and the others start drifting in and then we start talking about what's going on in life. Is there something that I've experienced that I might could share? Something that I've got a problem with that you've experienced that you can share? And all of those ideas that surround our being together. You know, we don't have church in a, we don't have virtual church where, you know, you watch it on a video. No, we're live and in person. And we need to do that. In chapter 13, there is the idea of love for the brethren. Let love of the brethren continue.
I don't know if there was a problem. As they were growing a little weaker, perhaps they kind of took each other for granted. And that's easy to do. You know, sometimes familiarity breeds contempt. But when people are faithful, that we never want to lose sight of that. There was a man who died recently down our way, and he came back. He years of negligence, but he and his wife both came back about 3 years ago. And he was just a very lovable man. As my wife said, he was a true gentleman. He was emphasis on the gentle. He was just a caring. And I told him, I said, Brother John, my dad used to say about people that he'd meet later in life. He said, I wish I had been able to know you earlier in life. Our paths had crossed earlier. You just appreciate certain people. They help you. It's Brother Gardner Hall used to say, it's easier to be good around certain people. It's easier to be bad around other people. Those kinds of people help you. And we ought not to ever take each other for granted, but express our appreciation for people and let love of the brethren continue. And the next verse, remember, forget not to show love unto strangers. Thereby some have entertained angels. That's a part of New Testament Christianity, of extending hospitality. And as we do that, we share in the good things of the gospel and encourage people. Verse 4, something that accompanies salvation are honorable scriptural marriages. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the bed be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers God will judge. It is to be held in an honorable estate, which it's not viewed as such among, honestly, if you've been married now for 10 or 15 years, that's ancient. It's among a lot of people. That's, Lee and I have been married, 33, something like that, 34 years now? Some young ladies where she is, hears that, I can't even imagine what that must be like. I said, well, it's not as bad as it seems. But the truth of the matter is, it ought to be held high. And let marriage be held in honor or an honorable estate. And the bed undefiled, for fornicators and adulterers God will judge. So do we appreciate the great salvation we have in Christ? And do our lives show it? There are things that accompany salvation, he said, and these things we thus speak. These are matters that are, I think, a part of the package deal of Christianity. It goes with being a Christian. And the apostle, the Lord expects this out of us, to grow and mature. We talked about faith this morning and how we have tests of faith. And we have that through life. But as we go through those tests, we need to be maturing. And all of these things that accompany salvation are part of that maturation process. If there's something we can do to help you, if you've obeyed the gospel and something's amiss, if we can help you, come to the front. And we stand and sing. If you haven't obeyed, then we hope you'll do that tonight. Let's do what's right. As together we stand and sing.